UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to bethinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Well, I'm Philip van der Elst, and I feel in talking to you about C.S. Lewis, leading a workshop about C.S. Lewis, I'm repaying an old debt, because I became a Christian through reading C.S. Lewis. I had this extraordinary journey of, really, of intellectual and spiritual discovery, of walking in the footsteps of a man who'd had all my intellectual objections to belief in God and the Christian faith. So I've spent my professional life in politics and journalism, and I became interested in Christian apologetics partly because I became a Christian through reading someone like C.S. Lewis and got interested in philosophy of religion and all the arguments for the existence of God, but also because about 8 years ago, I wrote a book about the thought of C.S. Lewis, which was published by a small publisher called Carriage Press, and I've continued speaking to different audiences about C.S. Lewis ever since, so you're only my latest victims. Now, before I talk about C.S. Lewis and his relevance in our present post-Christian culture, can I just ask for a show of hands, have all of you read something of C.S. Lewis? Have you all read something of C.S. Lewis? How many of you have read more than two of C.S. Lewis's books? Right.
It includes children's books.
And what about non-children's books? The apologetics, the theology, the philosophy?
A couple,
right. Okay. Well, what I intend to do is, this session lasts until 5:30. I shall certainly stop at 5:00, possibly 10 minutes earlier, and then that will leave plenty of at least half an hour or 40 minutes for discussion and question and answer. It's difficult to exaggerate the relevance of C.S. Lewis. Although he died in 1963, interestingly on the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated and Aldous Huxley died, you probably didn't know that, Carol, the same day as JFK went down in Dallas, Lewis died. Of course, his obituary wasn't noticed all that much because of the events surrounding the death of JFK, but he died on the same day. But despite the fact that he died in 1963, his books have continued to sell, and now it is estimated that the total worldwide sale of his books is now 200 million in over 30 languages. So I can't think of any Christian writer or apologist of the 20th century who can boast that degree of fruitfulness, if I may put it that way. And in fact, during the 1998 centenary celebrations of Lewis's birth, the American magazine Christianity Today described Lewis as the Aquinas, the Augustine, and the Aesop of contemporary evangelism. British Post Office even produced a special commemorative stamp featuring The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And according to Professor Adrian Hastings' History of Christianity in England, C.S. Lewis composed, in his opinion, almost single-handedly, and I quote, the popular apologetic of modern Britain. Well, what is the secret of Lewis's enduring popularity, and why is he relevant today? And I think the answer to that question is firstly because his character, his intellect, and his creativity. He wasn't only an Oxford academic and a popular theologian, he was also a poet. There's a whole volume of his poetry that exists, including, incidentally, a very beautiful poem about the unicorn, explaining why the unicorn is not found in our world today. It's really about Noah's Ark, and I can't remember the wording of the poem, but essentially the story the poem tells is that the gates of the Ark have been shut, the gate of the Ark has been shut, and Ham, Noah's wayward son, is the doorkeeper of the Ark, and the unicorn arrives late and bangs on the door with his horn, And Ham, who's a lazy so-and-so, can't be bothered to open the door of the ark. And so the unicorn, because the unicorn is such a proud creature, just without another, without begging or anything, just turns round and gallops off into the hills, and so perished in the flood. So that's why we don't have the unicorn in our world today. It's a lovely little poem of C.S. Lewis's, which you must try and get hold of in the book of his poetry. So he was a poet, as well as a popular theologian and an academic. And he was also, of course, a writer of science fiction. You've probably, all of you, read the Narnia books. How many of you have read a science fiction trilogy? You have, and Robert has. Right. So you begin to have a sense of the range of his communicating abilities. And he possessed this marvellously logical mind, this ability to communicate at many different levels to different audiences. And he was particularly good at using analogies, at using pictures, in order to explain abstract concepts. I think another of Lewis's great gifts and the secret of his ability to empathize with unbelievers was his own experience of suffering and the difficulty that suffering creates in believing in the existence and goodness of God. I don't know how many of you are familiar with his life or have read biographies of him, but he lost his mother at the age of 10. He loved her dearly. He was wounded. He served. He volunteered to fight in the First World War. He was an Ulsterman, an Irishman, Northern Ireland. Came from Northern Ireland. So he wasn't actually subject to conscription. You weren't if you were Irish in the First World War. But he nevertheless volunteered and served in the trenches as a young man and was wounded. I suppose fortunately, otherwise he might have gone on fighting and been killed. And he lost one of his best friends in that dreadful war. So it's not surprising that Lewis was an atheist and only came to God with extreme reluctance in 1929 at the age of 31 as a young Oxford don, a young Oxford academic. Lewis's relevance today can perhaps be summarized best in his own words from the preface to his best known and most popular theological work, Mere Christianity. Ever since I became a Christian, I have thought that perhaps the best, perhaps the only service I could do for my unbelieving neighbours was to explain and defend the belief. And he was, of course, so successful at doing that in the 1940s that he became known as the Apostle to the Skeptics. And he, in fact, the 1940s is really the most creative period of his philosophical and theological writing. In 1940, he wrote The Problem of Pain. Very apposite, just as the Second World War was getting underway. And it's because the head of the BBC Religious Affairs Department read The Problem of Pain that Lewis was asked to give his famous radio broadcasts about Christianity and God, which of course made him world famous. According to the BBC, about 50% of the radio audience, of the millions who listened to Lewis, were unbelievers. And there's a very interesting book that's come out called C.S. Lewis and the BBC by a man called Justin Phillips, who's a Christian and was a BBC radio producer. He died and his wife wrote a preface to the book. But that's a very interesting description of the relationship between C.S. Lewis and the BBC. And again, it gives you a sense of the extraordinary impact C.S. Lewis made on his generation and subsequently, that not only were those radio broadcasts during the war reaching millions of people, but the published version of those broadcasts, all brought together for the first time in Mere Christianity in 1952, have now sold over 1 million copies and are still in print. Now, one question I'm sometimes asked is, whatever the relevance of Lewis in the 1940s or the 1950s or even in the early 60s, is he still relevant today? And I think the answer is obviously yes. If he wasn't, his books wouldn't continue to be selling on a huge scale, especially in the United States. And also, since he became so effective in critiquing atheism and scientific materialism and moral relativism and all these secularizing trends in our culture, and these secularizing trends have only increased in strength since he died, I think he's more relevant than ever before. There's no doubt from opinion surveys that there are a higher proportion of atheists and agnostics now, at least in the population of Britain, than there were in his day. According to one survey in the year 2000, the number of people actively disbelieving in God has risen from 2% to 27% since the 1950s. And one third of those who do profess to believe in God don't believe in a personal God. So they might as well not believe in God at all. Another recent survey shows only 7% now say that they are Christian churchgoers, and 48% claim they have no religion. And these statistics actually underestimate the degree of atheism and agnosticism in our population, because if you look at our intellectual elite, you look at the people who are in charge of publishing and academics in universities, scientists and so on, journalists, you will typically find something like 70% or more are atheists or agnostics. Even in America, which is a much more overtly, much more Christianized country, far larger proportion of population going to church, even in America, you find that surveys show something like 80, 90% of the intellectual elite, of journalists, for example, don't believe in God. So the problem of atheism and agnosticism is a very serious one today, and therefore Lewis's apologetic, which was particularly effective in reaching out to atheists, is more relevant than ever before. So what I'm going to do now, for most of the time that remains of my talk, is to just take you through his critique of atheism and his arguments for the existence of God and the truth of Christianity. Now, I presume you've all got a copy of my paper, and I'll just take you through one argument after another under the C.S. Lewis's Apologetics argument headings, 4.1. That's on page 2. The self-contradiction of atheism in relation to the problem of evil. If our moral standard is subjective, the case against God collapses. If it is objective, how can it be the product of a random and purposeless universe? The problem of evil. The argument that Lewis deployed in Mere Christianity and in other in a lecture he also gave to the students of Wadham College at the beginning of the Second World War, was that when people complain about the existence of injustice or suffering or the problem of evil, they have in their minds a concept of justice, of righteousness, of goodness, of happiness, which is what makes them react against evil and suffering and injustice. And so the great question arises, how does one view this sense, this internal sense of right and wrong, this sense of justice and righteousness? How do we think about that? Because that is the standard of measurement by which we determine that there is evil in the world and there's suffering and it's intolerable. And basically, the argument is that either this standard of right and wrong, this inner sense of meaning and justice, is simply subjective, like our taste for food and clothing. But if it is purely subjective, then we can't really use it as an argument against the existence of God. It would be a bit like complaining about the law of gravity, because you can't jump off buildings without hurting yourself. If, on the other hand, we take our sense of right and wrong, our sense of justice, seriously, then when we look at the evil in the world and the suffering, and we complain about it, we must then ask ourselves, where does this objective standard of right and wrong, justice and injustice, come from? If atheists are correct in saying that there is no God, how can we attach any significance to the moral law written on our hearts? How can we attach any significance to our standard of right or wrong? How can we attach any objectivity to our values? How can we say that they are eternal insights into reality if our minds and all our thoughts are simply the inevitable end product of our biochemistry, of a long chain of non-rational, physical, random events? If we are the accidental products of an accidental universe, how can we attach any significance to our thoughts? And that's a big problem for atheists. And Lewis describes it very well in Mere Christianity. This is what he says in Mere Christianity. In the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, in other words, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as, if there were no light in the universe, and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. Shows a characteristic of Lewis's mode of thinking and argument. He just turns the tables on atheism. Well, if our sense of right and wrong, our sense of justice and injustice, is something objective, what are the metaphysical implications, if you like, of the fact that we have this objective sense of right and wrong in our hearts? Now, as Lewis has just argued in Mere Christianity, and as I've been arguing before quoting him, atheists don't have an adequate explanation of this inner sense of right and wrong, of our moral awareness. Now, that, I believe, is the truth. However, many atheists will deny this, and they will say, no, it isn't true that our moral awareness, our sense of right and wrong, points to the existence of God. We have explanations for our sense of right and wrong, which explain this without any need to introduce God into the picture. And the three common arguments that atheists use to explain how it is that we have this inner sense of right and wrong, this inner moral standard on our hearts, the three kinds of explanation are instinct, survival value, and social utility, what is good for society. So let's look at the argument from instinct. The reason we have this sense of right and wrong, we have a moral awareness, is because it's a matter of instinct. We have an instinct to help others. We have an instinct to save a child who falls into a frozen lake. It's just a matter of instinct. But the problem about saying that our moral awareness, our moral sense, is a matter of instinct, is that our instincts are often in conflict. And our moral awareness, our moral sense, is the faculty or the something inside us that enables us to choose between our conflicting instincts. Now, the example C.S. Lewis uses in Mere Christianity and in other places is that if you're walking, you're going for a walk in some park or in the countryside, and you see a child fall into a frozen lake in the middle of winter, you'll have an instinct to help that child, to rescue that child, to dive into the lake yourself. An instinct to help others, if you like, but you've also got a survival instinct which warns you that if you jump into that frozen lake, you may drown. However, you also have something else. In addition to these two conflicting instincts, you have a sense that you ought to follow the instinct to jump into the lake and rescue the child, and you ought to suppress the instinct to just save your own skin and not take any risks. Now, obviously, something that enables you to choose between the instincts cannot be itself another instinct. And in fact, the picture Lewis uses, and this is again a very good example of the way he uses pictures, is that he says, think of a piano, the notes on a piano, and the sheet of music. The instincts are like the notes on a piano, all the different notes, the little black ones and the white ones, and the sheet music tells you what notes to play. And our moral law, our moral instinct, our sense of right and wrong, the moral law, as Lewis calls it in Mere Christianity, is like the sheet music that enables you to know how to play the piano, how to strike the notes. And of course, just as a law implies, just as a sheet of music, musical manuscript implies the existence of a composer, an intelligent composer, so a moral law implies a lawgiver. Well, another argument atheists use is, well, okay, you've knocked down the argument from instinct. Well, it's survival value. The reason we have this moral sense is that it is what enables us as human beings to survive. And our moral sense, our sense of right and wrong, has survival value, and that's why we have it and that's why we obey it. But actually, if you look at the history of, first of all, if you look at nature, you see nature red in tooth and claw. And if you look at human society, if you look at the history of the world, it's very hard to argue. I mean, a Martian, you know, someone from another planet, observing the way human beings actually behave, would not necessarily assume we have a moral law written on our hearts. Most of history has been a story of war, oppression, tyranny, murder. For most human beings, life has been nasty, brutish, and short. And if you look at our society today, if you look at the number of people who are successful criminals, or the number of countries ruled by dictatorships, it's very hard to argue that goodness, kindness, honesty, integrity are a sort of passport to success and have great survival value in the jungle of human society. Anyone who really thinks deeply or seriously about history and about human life and society will, I think, agree that the survival value argument is a very weak explanation for morality. Then we have the third and most obviously, what seems to be the most convincing non-theistic, non-Christian explanation of morality, and that is, well, what is good is what is good for society. We mustn't steal or kill because that's bad for society. We can't live together. But the problem is that involves a circular argument. Why should I care about society? If I'm clever and ruthless and can organize myself with a gang of other people to support me in leading a life of crime or taking over a country and establishing a dictatorship, why should I care about the rights of other people? Why shouldn't I just do what I want if I can get away with it? And again, if you consider the fact that at least half of all crimes are never solved or even detected by the police, and if you think about the fact that half the countries in the United Nations are governed by dictatorships, and that most of history has been a story of oppression and war, again, it is hard to argue that what is good for society is a particularly effective explanation of why we have this sense of right and wrong. And so it seems to me that in the end, when we look at our sense of right and wrong, when we look at the moral law, we are faced with a choice, metaphysically, between two possible attitudes. One is that our sense of right and wrong is just subjective. That's the nihilistic position. It's just a matter of taste and choice, what you want to believe is right and what you want to believe is wrong. And frankly, faced with a nihilist, you know, what can you do? Kill him, I suppose, imprison him or shoot him, because he'll destroy society if he persuades everybody to think the way he does. Or alternatively, you can say no. Our sense of right and wrong, our belief in the value of human life, which is what underpins this idea that we ought to care about society, is simply a self-evident truth. It's an axiom. It's like the truths of logic or mathematics. It's simply a self-evident truth that you shouldn't torture children, that you shouldn't tell lies, that we ought to love each other rather than hate each other. These are self-evident truths. And you either recognize them, or if you do not recognize them, you are the moral equivalent of colorblind. And that's the only... And since the overwhelming majority of human beings are not nihilists, or in fact relativists, they may think they're relativists. If you meet relativists, people say, oh, well, you know, morality is just a matter of choice. All you have to do is to just ask them a few test questions. So you think it's okay for the Ku Klux Klan to burn down black churches, do you? Because they feel like it. You think it was all right for Hitler to exterminate 6 million Jews, because to him that felt good. You think it's okay to sexually abuse children, because that's what paedophiles like doing. And as soon as you start asking these questions, you can actually destroy this, you know, people's belief that actually they're relativists or nihilists. So this is a very effective form of apologetics, to make people think about moral values and our sense of right and wrong, and then think, well, what are the philosophical implications of that? And that's what Lewis does. And Lewis shows us that this leads us to what's called the moral argument for the existence of God. Because where does this sense of right and wrong come from? This sense of right and wrong obviously is independent of our own existence. Whether we live or die, it is still wrong to torture children. It is still wrong to hate. It is still right to love. It is still wrong to tell lies. So the moral law, goodness if you like, is independent of whether we recognize it or not, or whether we exist or not. And it has nothing to do either with simply what we want. You know, you see a beautiful woman, you want to commit adultery with her. But you know that adultery is wrong. So it's not a matter of, you know, our moral sense isn't a matter of what we want, because so often what is right and what is wrong is in conflict with what we want. So it's not a matter of desire. So you have this goodness that is somehow independent of us and outside ourselves. But if you think about it, goodness is linked to intelligence. It is a mind that recognizes a law. It is a mind that recognizes truth. So truth and goodness is related to intelligence. And therefore it's perfectly reasonable to believe that this goodness that in a sense is independent of us and is somehow outside and beyond the physical universe is linked to an intelligence, is in fact the self-manifestation, if you like, the self-expression of a supreme mind, which is, of course, God. That's essentially the moral argument for the existence of God. Another argument that C.S. Lewis uses against atheism is that atheists cannot give an adequate explanation of religious experience, of the religious impulse in human beings. I'm not, incidentally, necessarily going to have time to go into all his arguments, but that's why the paper exists, that you can meditate on it in your own time. The interesting thing about belief in God is that if there is no God, if all that exists is simply this material universe, which atheists tell us, you know, is all that there is, how is it that we who are the products of this material universe can imagine some greater reality outside that universe? It's actually quite puzzling. It's rather like fish being aware of feeling wet. How can you look outside the circle if you're simply a product of the circle? If you're inside the circle, how can your thought transcend that physical reality and reach beyond the circle to something outside, to God? And then how do you explain what C.S. Lewis called the inconsolable longing? The fact that so often we have, I suppose this is true of most people, we've had some time in our existence, an experience of some incredible beauty or longing, something coming to us seemingly from outside, something inexpressibly beautiful and wonderful that speaks to us through a beautiful landscape or a beautiful painting or a wonderful piece of music, that sense of some sense of transcendence that communicates itself to us and which Lewis called the inconsolable longing. Is this not significant, and how do atheists explain it? And here I will quote from his writings on this subject. This is what he says in Mere Christianity. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. In another paper he wrote called Encounter with Light, Lewis writes, how could an idiotic universe have produced creatures whose mere dreams are so much stronger, better, subtler than itself? Do fish, now again, this is Lewis's example, the way he uses pictures. Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? Or if they did, would that fact itself not strongly suggest that they had not always been, or would not always be, purely aquatic animals? If you are really a product of a materialistic universe, how is it that you don't feel at home there? And then even more powerfully, making the same argument, this is what he said in another sermon. Do what they will, then, we remain conscious of a desire which no natural happiness will satisfy. But is there any reason to suppose that reality offers any satisfaction to it? And here again, we're going to come to a physical picture, an analogy that Lewis uses. A man's physical hunger does not prove that that man will get any bread. He may die of starvation on a raft in the Atlantic. But surely a man's hunger does prove that he comes of a race which repairs its body by eating and drinking, and which inhabits a world where eatable substances exist. In the same way, though I do not believe, I wish I did, that my desire for paradise proves that I shall enjoy it, I think it a pretty good indication that such a thing exists, and that some men will. A man may love a woman and not win her, but it would be very odd if the phenomenon called falling in love occurred in a sexless world. That's a very good picture, isn't it? Of the significance of the religious impulse and the inability of atheists to explain the religious impulse, that almost universal belief among human beings historically that there is a God, that there is a supernatural reality, that the physical world that surrounds them isn't all that exists. Lewis also argued another reason why we need to reject atheism is that atheists cannot explain the existence of reason and free will. Now, that philosophically is a slightly more difficult argument, but Lewis's argument basically goes like this. In ordinary conversation, we reject arguments that can be clearly shown to have illogical, irrational premises. I mean, for example, if you say, the only reason you defend capitalism is because you're a rich man, and the person making that argument is saying that I do not accept the arguments for capitalism because I believe that the arguments for capitalism are motivated by not by truth, but simply by the self-interest of capitalists or economists paid by capitalists to make their case. So in ordinary, and we can think of lots of other examples. You only say that because you're a woman. You only say that because you're a sports fanatic. In ordinary conversation, we reject conclusions or arguments that can be shown to be have an irrational or non-rational basis. But the problem about atheism is that if atheists are correct in saying that there's no God, that we are simply the byproducts, the accidental byproducts of a meaningless and purposeless universe, then the logical consequence of thinking that is that all our thought processes, all our arguments, are themselves simply the inevitable and accidental end product of a long chain of non-rational, accidental physical and chemical events. So how can we attach any significance to our thinking? In other words, what atheists do, argues Lewis, is that they destroy the credentials of reasoning, of our reasoning powers. But of course, and of course, in the process of doing that, they destroy the arguments for atheism. Because if the thoughts that we think and the arguments that we believe are simply an inevitable consequence of a long chain of non-rational physical and chemical events, then the arguments for atheism are as discredited as any other arguments. But of course, you can't argue that there's no such thing as truth. You can't reason that there's no such thing as reason, because that's self-contradictory. We know that we can reason. It's obvious that we can reason. Any philosophical debate or argument about atheism or whatever presupposes that we can reason. And therefore, we have to explain the fact that we are able to reason, we are able to discover truth. And the only way we can explain our ability to reason and discover truth is because our minds, we are created by God, and our minds, if you like, are illuminated by the divine reason that has always existed and that exists. A very similar argument can be used about free will. If atheism is true and there's no God and we're only the inevitable byproduct of an accidental universe, how can we have free will? If we're simply biochemical robots, how can we have free will? But of course, we do have free will. Because to argue that you don't have free will is itself contradictory. No one, a determinist, determinism is the philosophical label for those who deny free will, determinists. And a famous scientific determinist was a man called B.F. Skinner, a behaviorist, who said we have no free will. But if you follow the logic of determinism, that we have no free will, then it means that the thoughts of determinists, their conclusions that we have no free will, according to their own argument, has also been determined. So how do we know it's true? You see, they've slit their throats again. So simply because of the self-contradictory nature of determinism, we know that we have free will, and of course we experience free will. We are able to choose between different items of food on a menu in a restaurant. We are able to choose our life's partner, or what occupation to follow, or what book to read, or where to go on holiday. We know that we have free will. But again, we cannot explain the existence of free will, our possession of free will, without introducing God, without recognizing the fact that we are made in the image of God. We have been created by that supreme mind, that supreme intelligence beyond and outside the universe. If you want to follow Lewis's arguments about reason and free will and so on, the best book is Miracles, his book Miracles, where he sort of proves the existence of God in the first three chapters by showing that atheism cannot make sense of human consciousness. That's really what Lewis does, either at the moral level or the intellectual level. He deals with some of these arguments at a simpler level in various points in Mere Christianity. But Miracles is the key book to read on that front. Atheism cannot explain the existence and order of the universe, both of which indicate God's existence as the creator and designer of all things. Well, I don't know, were you all in the Apologetics Network listening to William Lane Craig? Okay, well, the cosmological argument for the existence of God is basically what's often and misleadingly called the first cause argument. And essentially it is this: something cannot come from nothing. Or another way of saying the same thing, nothing cannot produce something. Well, first of all, that's logically obvious, isn't it? Nothing is the absence of something, so nothing cannot explain how its opposite comes into existence. So we know that something cannot come from nothing, or, if you like to put it another way, nothing cannot produce something. So that means that for anything to exist, it must either be itself eternal and self-existent, contain within itself the reason for its existence, or it must have been brought into existence, created by something else or someone else that has always existed and could not exist. Now, if you look at the universe, what is the universe? Well, it's simply the sort of collective word for everything that exists. And what is this everything that exists? Well, life forms that come into existence, that are born, come into existence, change over time and then cease to exist. Or it consists of processes that begin, change, and change into something else and end. So if you look at everything that there is in the universe, particularly, of course, at human beings, animals and whatever, you see beings or structures that do not contain within themselves the reasons for their existence. Because there was a time they didn't exist, then they exist, then they cease to exist. And so since the universe doesn't explain itself, doesn't account for its existence, it must be the creation of something or someone that does exist and has always existed. And if you think about the biblical text, when God says to Moses, "I am who I am," another way of understanding that is, I am self-existence. I am the one who always exists and who could not exist. And if you then think about, so we know that there's something or someone who exists, who is the creator, and then you think about what exists: intelligence, personality, life in us. Then obviously the creator, the first cause, if you like, is intelligent, creative, is personal, and so on. And so that's part of the philosophical argument for the existence of God. Now, Lewis didn't write a great deal, he didn't sort of say a lot about that, but he did He did summarize the argument, what's called a cosmological argument for the existence of God, in a rather nice way. And again, it shows his powers of communication, the way he can take an abstract philosophical argument and make it vivid to ordinary people by using an analogy, a picture. An egg, which came from no bird, is no more natural than a bird which has existed from all eternity. And since the egg-bird sequence leads us to no plausible beginning, is it not reasonable to look for the real origin somewhere outside the sequence of birds and eggs and so on? You have to go outside the sequence of engines into the world of men to find the real originator of the rocket. Is it not equally reasonable to look outside nature for the real originator of the natural order? Beautiful way of putting the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Now we come to the next and important part of C.S. Lewis's apologetic, which is miracles, supernatural events. One of the problems that, certainly it was the problem I had when I was an atheist, one of the reasons I never took the gospel stories seriously and didn't begin to listen to the preaching of the gospel when I was an atheist, was because I believed God didn't exist, and I believed that therefore miracles were impossible. But the problem about this argument, that miracles are impossible because scientific laws, natural laws, are uniform. You know, the sun always rises in the east, you always have a law of gravity. If you get leprosy, your skin peels off, and if you get cancer, you'll automatically die. The problem about these laws of physics, or these natural laws, these scientific laws, the problem about assuming that they are uniform is that unless you introduce the idea of God, the existence of God, you cannot make this assumption that there are objective, unalterable scientific laws. Because if the universe is basically accidental and chaotic and purposeless, why should we assume that there are any scientific laws? Why should we assume that because an experiment reveals something we might call the law of gravity, or reveal some other scientific law, that law is going to apply tomorrow or in some other parts of the universe? There's no reason for believing that unless you first believe that nature is ordered because there is a creator. And in fact, if you look at the history of the rise of empirical science in the Western world, you will find that all the great scientists and thinkers of the past believed in God, believed in a creator, believed in an intelligent designer. And it was because they believed in an intelligent designer, they believed in a creator, they believed in a lawgiver, if you like, they believed that there was therefore scientific laws or natural laws, an ordered nature to investigate and to discover. So Lewis's argument on the subject of miracles, especially in his book Miracles, is that the argument against miracles, that natural laws are never change, are never violated, you know, dead men never rise from the grave, is a kind of circular argument. It's just an affirmation that first of all, it's a circular argument because it's another way of saying no miracles have ever taken place. So before you even investigate the evidence for miracles, you've simply ruled them out because of your presupposition. But that presupposition that there are scientific laws cannot itself be justified without introducing the existence of God. But if God exists, then he obviously can. It is ridiculous to argue that he cannot interfere with or suspend the laws he himself created. And in this book, Miracles, Lewis uses the example of a railway timetable. If you look at a railway timetable, you know, you'll find that, I don't know, there's always the a train leaving Victoria Station in London every day at 11 in the morning to go to Edinburgh. Now, you can look at that timetable till you're blue in the face, and that will never tell you whether or not that schedule is going to change. In order to know whether or not it's possible for the time of the train leaving London Victoria to go to Edinburgh might be 12 noon instead of 11, is by eavesdropping on the conversation in the station master's office. So if God exists, if there's a lawgiver, creator, then he can suspend the laws he's created and he can interfere with the nature that he's created. It's rather like an author of a play. I mean, obviously Shakespeare could rewrite parts of Hamlet. Obviously Sherlock Holmes could change the ending of one of his Sherlock Holmes stories. You know, the Hound of the Baskervilles you know, does eat the hero, you know. Poor old Dr. Watson disappears in his jaws. I mean, he could have written that. Well, if on, so you see, on the human level, and the Bible tells us we're made in the image of God, we see that we can interfere with our own works. We can change a painting, we can change a story, we can change a play. So God can interfere with nature. So there's no problem about miracles. And the other thing Lewis does in his book on miracles is that he actually shows that the miracles recorded of Jesus in the New Testament are very significant. They are not arbitrary happenings. They're not like magic in fairy tales. You don't find Jesus producing a talking tree or turning stones into bread. You don't have this kind of arbitrary. You don't find these arbitrary acts in his ministry. What you see in his ministry is the localization and speeding up of what God actually does in nature. For example, I'm going to read you a quote here, actually, because it makes the argument much better than I can. And it's a brilliant... It's right. I'm partly quoting from my own commentary in the book I wrote on Lewis, and then I'll be giving you a quote from him. So I write here, instead of beasts turning into men, talking trees or magic rings, we read, for example, of water turning into wine, or a few loaves and fishes feeding thousands, miracles which represent a speeding up and localization of what usually occurs gradually and generally in nature. What they tell us is that the God who created the universe, and with it the natural processes by which water and seedlings of wheat are annually turned into wine and bread with the cooperation of human labour, once short-circuited these processes and performed the same miracles as man in ancient Palestine. Now here's the quote from Lewis. God creates the vine and teaches it to draw up water by its roots, and with the aid of the sun to turn that water into a juice which will ferment and take on certain qualities. Thus, every year, from Noah's time till ours, God turns water into wine. That men fail to see. Either like the pagans, they refer the process to some finite spirit, or God, like Bacchus or Dionysus, or else like the moderns, he means like modern atheists, they attribute real and ultimate causality to the chemical and other material phenomena, which are all that our senses can discover in it. But when Christ at Cana makes water into wine, the mask is off. The miracle has only half its effect if it only convinces us that Christ is God. It will have its full effect if whenever we see a vineyard or drink a glass of wine, we remember that here works he who sat at the wedding party in Cana. That same mysterious energy, which we call gravitational when it steers the planet, and biochemical when it heals the body, is the efficient cause of all recoveries. And if God exists, that energy, directly or indirectly, is his. All who are cured, you think of the body's immune system, all who are cured by him, the healer within, creator created our bodies, created our immune system. But once, he did it visibly, a man meeting a man. So Lewis's argument is that Christ's miracles show God as man speeding up, in doing locally and sort of speeded up what he does in nature. And that, again, that's a wonderful argument. I mean, that was one of the books that converted me from atheism and made me a Christian. This showed me that, you know, the New Testament, these stories in the Gospel make sense. If there is a God, and he became man, that's the sort of thing he would have done. Those are the sort of miracles you would expect to see. And Lewis argues this brilliantly. Well, I've only got another 3 minutes. And, you know, there's so much. I mean, the trouble about talking about Lewis is a bit like talking about the works of Shakespeare, you know, or the story of science, you know, in one go. And I can't possibly cover everything. But I just want to say one other thing about Lewis's apologetic, which shows the way he's able to combine imagination with rational, logical argument. And that's the point 4.9. the superficiality of scientific objections to Christianity based on the size of the universe in relation to the Earth and the possible existence of other inhabited planets and intelligent species. Now, I don't know how often it's occurred to any of you to wonder about how is the truth of Christianity affected by the possibility that one day scientists might discover that there are other inhabited planets, that we are not alone in the universe. And Lewis interestingly said, this rather interesting, he said, you find opposite arguments put up against Christianity. On the one hand, atheists argue, how can you say that that God exists and God cares so much about human beings that he became man and became a man in Jesus and came to first century Palestine, when we're just the only life forms on this little speck of earth, in this whole vast universe, and there isn't any life anywhere else, doesn't that suggest that life is just an accident? Then you get the opposite argument saying, the universe is teeming with intelligent life. There are lots of other inhabited planets. So how can you say there's anything special about human beings and the Earth? And imagine that God came down and became a man in order to save us from I don't know what. It's absurd. And now Lewis deals with these arguments very effectively. He wrote a paper years ago called Religion and Rocketry, and where he sets out his arguments, in a straight fashion. And he also deals with some of these themes in his science fiction trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Voyage to Venus, and That Hideous Strength. And basically Lewis's counterattack on the skeptical atheist, talking about, what about other inhabited planets? His counterattack takes two forms. First of all, Lewis points out the fallacy of attaching significance to size. And Lewis argued, to say that the Earth is somehow not important to God because it's the only inhabited, it's a tiny little planet in the midst of a vast universe, is rather like saying that a horse is more significant and important than a man because the horse is bigger than a man. Or it's rather like saying that the leg is more important than the brain because the leg is bigger than the brain. Obviously, there's no significance in terms of value, that it simply attaches to size for its own sake. The second argument Lewis uses is that the whole point of the incarnation of the Christian gospel is that the good shepherd goes in search of the lost sheep. It's not because of any merit in human beings that the Lord came down to earth. It's because he is love, and therefore loves infinitely. It isn't any merit in human beings that draws God's love. He is love, and because he is love, he has created us, called us into existence, and rescued us in our sins. And we cannot make any assumptions about the consequences for the truth of Christianity from the existence of other planets, because there's so many presuppositions which are not really rational. So again, to make this point, I'm partly quoting from my own book and then again from Lewis. Christ, in Miracles, Lewis writes, Christ did not die for men because they were intrinsically worth dying for, but because he is intrinsically love and therefore loves infinitely. I put in my commentary, it is because we are fallen and therefore in a sense not worth dying for that God visited our planet, just as it's the one lost sheep the good shepherd seeks in Jesus' famous parable, not the 99 righteous who never strayed. As for the problem supposedly posed by the existence, the possible existence of other intelligent species, it too melts away on closer examination. And here is a quote again from Miracles. The skeptic asks how we can believe that God so came down to this one tiny planet. The question would be embarrassing if we knew, one, that there are rational creatures on any of the other bodies that float in space, two, that they have, like us, fallen and need redemption, three, that their redemption must be in the same mode as ours, four, that redemption in this mode has been withheld from them. But we know none of them. We know none of these things. The universe may be full of happy lives that never needed redemption. It may be full of lives that have been redeemed in modes suitable to their condition, of which we can form no conception. It may be full of lives that have been redeemed in the very same mode as our own. It may be full of things quite other than life, in which God is interested, though we are not. And then he says, Lewis says, if the universe is teeming with life other than ours, then this, we are told, makes it quite ridiculous to believe that God should be so concerned with the human race as to come down from heaven. And if he made man and be made man for its redemption, if, on the other hand, our planet is really unique in harbouring organic life, then this is thought to prove that life is only an accidental byproduct in the universe, and so again to disprove our religion. We treat God as the policeman in the story treated the suspect. Whatever he does will be used in evidence against him. This is an example of Lewis's wit. Well, that's Lewis on the possible problems that might be posed to Christianity from the existence of other inhabited beings and other planets. I think I'll stop there. Except I'll just say one word about evil. One of the interesting things in Lewis's writing is, having dismissed the atheist view of evil, that this somehow disproves the existence of God, and having taken evil seriously, Lewis then basically says, well, if there is a good God, why do we have evil? We know that God exists, we've been able to establish that from our arguments, but then why is there evil? And he basically says there are only two explanations. One is what's called dualism, which was important in the ancient Persian religion of Zoroastrianism, which was there basically two gods. There's a sort of good God responsible for everything good, and there's an evil God responsible for everything evil. But the problem with dualism is that how do we know which God is good and which God is evil? That suggests that there's some third standard, the moral law of right and wrong, which is somehow prior to and superior to these two gods, and which tells you that this God is evil and this God is good. So that doesn't really work philosophically. And there's another reason why it doesn't work philosophically, which is that evil, if you think about it, is really a perversion of or rebellion against good. In order for something to become evil, it first has to have been good. For example, an evil person is using will, intelligence, existence in the wrong way. But will, intelligence, existence are in themselves good. So therefore there is a sense in which metaphysically, philosophically, evil has to be derivative and not original. And therefore the biblical explanation of evil, that evil is a result of rebellion against good, the rebellion of creatures against their creator, is the only explanation, metaphysical explanation of evil that makes sense. And of course then Lewis talks about why does God give us free will, which alone makes evil possible. And of course the argument is that God gave us free will because unless we have free will, we cannot be made in his image, we cannot love him, we cannot know what love is, we would just be robots, we would just be like clockwork toys. And therefore, in order to be real, in order to be able to share God's love, to be made in his image, to love each other, to be creative, to enter into the fullness of life in the fullest sense of the word life, we must have free will. And if you have free will, it is possible to misuse it and to rebel. And of course that's what the story of the fall is all about, the rebellion of creatures against their creator. And since the creator is the source of all life, to rebel against the creator is to use the picture Lewis uses, is to be like a plant refusing to grow towards the sunlight. It inevitably results in spiritual and physical death. So Lewis is apologetic, not only smashes atheism to pieces, but he actually makes sense of scripture. And he makes us as Christians think about the biblical doctrines of the creation and the fall and so on. And it makes sense to us because He gives you a framework of explanation and understanding that enables you to understand a text better. Well, I've gone on a little longer than I wanted to. Hard not to when you're talking about Lewis. I haven't said anything about the Narnia books, but we can talk about this in questions and discussion. So, fire away. Yeah, go on. No, well.
Some of the philosophical thoughts about C.S. Lewis, so you can answer them if you like in terms of how C.S. Lewis might answer. So,
yeah.
The evil one, for instance, did Lewis ever take on the instances, for example, in the Bible where God seems to cause evil things to happen in order to bring about his purposes?
Actually, I'll stay seated. It's a bit ridiculous me standing. Really what you're talking about is the, if you like, the providence of God.
Yes,
he did. He does. I mean, he talks about that in the, I think the book where he talks about that the most is in The Problem of Pain. The best writing of Lewis on the problem of evil and all the sort of questions it throws up, it can be found in The Problem of Pain. And one of the points he makes about, I'm not sure I'm perhaps answering your question indirectly, but one of the points he makes about innocent suffering, that's right, take the problem of innocent suffering. I think most people can appreciate that, okay, God gives human beings free will, and they then misuse it, and if they then, you know, if that means that they then suffer, that's their own fault, and everybody can see the justice of that. But the question that often arises is, what about innocent suffering? You know, what about children, say, who were murdered, you know, like something like that? And Lewis's argument basically is that God could not create a world of free agents. It's not possible to create free will, to give human beings free will and prevent innocent suffering. And the reason is the following. Supposing I'm about to stab you with my penknife in the back. God, you know, you're a good guy, and you love God and all the rest of it, and I'm not, and I've rebelled against him, but I decide to, you know, because I enjoy killing people, I'm about to stab you in the back with my penknife. God, of course, could, in order to stop you being killed, in order to prevent innocent suffering, to stop that child being killed, God would have to turn the blade of the dagger or the penknife into a blade of grass. Alternatively, if I want to shout abuse at you, God could have commanded the airwaves not to transmit the horrible sounds coming out of my mouth, the sounds of abuse and all the rest of it. But if God actually did that in order to prevent innocent suffering, he would actually make free will impossible. You wouldn't be able to do anything wrong, so you wouldn't have any free will. So that's the problem. And so the problem for God is to the problem God faced, as it, if you like, once the fall took place, once the rebellion took place, was how to manifest his goodness in a world of free agents where people rebel against him. And so you have the problem that comes after the fall, that God's justice at one level demands that the penalty of sin be paid in full. On the other hand, his mercy, and you could argue partly his justice, his desire to rescue the innocent and his desire to rescue mankind as a whole from the consequences of their rebellion, means that there must be a way must be found by which the debt owed to his justice is paid, but at the same time death does not, you know, spiritually and physically is not the lasting destiny of human beings. And of course the answer is the incarnation and the cross, that on the cross Jesus pays the price owed to, you know, to God's judge. I mean, rather like the picture that's been used is that of, you know, a judge who finds his son, who finds, you know, and then takes off his robes and pays the price himself, pays the fine himself. Justice is done, but so is mercy. And so that's the reason for the, and that, you know, that's the reason for the incarnation and the atonement. So that's God's ultimate answer. So another way of responding to the problem of innocent suffering is that not only is innocent suffering made inevitable by the gift of free will and its subsequent misuse, but that isn't the end of the story. God has a rescue plan, And if people don't then choose to accept the rescue plan, you know, that's their own fault.
So, according to this, God wasn't in control of everything, absolutely. His lordship is not.
No, no, it's not saying that. No, it's... well, only in the sense that by an act of abdication, if you like, God... Well, you could put it another way, because isn't it extraordinary? And doesn't it show the extraordinary power of God that he can create human beings, people, creatures made in his image, and give them the ability or the possibility of resisting him? It's not that he somehow loses power or hasn't got the power, but he abdicates, you know, he gives us, rather like, you know, imagine, you know, your children, you know, you allow your child, you give your child pocket money or something, you might go and spend it on, you know, on pornography or something instead of improving books or going to concerts or something, you know, and you're not dictating what he does with that money. You're deliberately giving him freedom because he needs the freedom to grow. But God always remains in control. In this, I mean, if you think about the story of Jesus, I mean, at the point where he's arrested, you know, betrayed, arrested, and then flogged and crucified and tortured to death. I mean, that's the most terrible series of events. But yet God fulfills his purpose, the great purpose of redemption, not only despite the opposition and resistance of evil human beings or rebellious human beings, but even through it. So God is always sovereign and always in control, even though often it appears that he isn't. And Lewis would argue, that's the sort of thing Lewis argued. I mean, it's very hard to accept at the human level if you're going through suffering. You know, you feel, you know, you've been abandoned. And of course Lewis, I mean, when Lewis's wife died, as you know, have you all seen the film Shadowlands? Mm-hmm. Well, he loved this woman, he married her and so on, and then she dies of cancer. And he wrote a book called A Grief Observed. How many of you have read A Grief Observed? Well, there you see the story of his grief and how it caused him to question his faith, but how he came through it all. And do you know that when the first edition of that book was published anonymously under a pseudonym, it was only because someone recognized his handwriting that they knew, oh, that's C.S. Lewis, but it was published, the first edition, under an assumed name. And it's such a strong and brave book, and ultimately faith-affirming book, that a lot of his friends, who didn't realize he'd written the book, sent him gift copies of his own book to comfort him. His house was full of gift copies of A Grief Observed. Now that tells you something about this guy. Why I just, you know, I can talk about him all day long. Sorry, that's a rather rambling response to your very important questions. But anyone else want to? I need to. Robert, you look as if you want to.
Supplemental to that.
Yeah.
The picture of the person with the penknife.
Yeah.
Presumably, it wouldn't be right to say that it's impossible for God to stop that.
No, of course not. Of course, he could have done
that. Restrain the person.
Yeah.
So in a sense, if that action goes forward and the good person is attacked, then in some sense, God is allowing that.
Yeah. And that's true, Robert, and actually this does create a problem for faith, because I think, if you think about, for example, the subject of healing, you know, miraculous healings, you know, we all pray when our loved ones or friends get sick, you know, we pray for them. And sometimes, you know, I mean, I, you know, there are miracles, people are healed of, well, I mean, like Lewis's wife, I mean, a guy laid hands on, and you don't see that in Shadowlands, by the way, but she was actually in real... She was dying of bone cancer in this hospital in Oxford, at the Radcliffe. And one of Lewis's friends, who was an Anglican priest with a sort of healing ministry, laid hands on her and prayed. And the cancer left her bones, you know, almost immediately. I mean, she was completely rock solid. The bones became rock solid and healthy. And Lewis and his wife felt, you know, God had given her a remission. And they would have a period of happiness together. But then he would take her away again. And that does come through in Shadowlands, but Shadowlands doesn't show her being prayed over. Now, I think the problem for us as Christians is that we see God intervening, if you like, in all sorts of cases to heal people or to prevent something bad happening to them, but then he doesn't intervene in other cases. So why does he intervene in one case, not in another? I mean, I don't know how many of you have read the books or heard the tapes of very good Baptist preacher and writer called David Pawson. But David Pawson is he's incidentally written a very good book on the Bible called Unlocking the Bible, which is a good overview of the Bible. And he gave a talk once, which I remember attending, where he said his wife once had cancer, very bad cancer, and God miraculously healed her. But his daughter also got cancer, and the Lord took her away. She died. Why was his wife healed miraculously, but his daughter died? And I think it's because God intervened. If God never intervened, and you know, prayer for healing never worked, you know, if God said to all of us, well, you know, the world has fallen, I've redeemed you through Christ, but while you're in what C.S. Lewis called the Shadowlands, you're just going to have to grin and bear, you know, all the problems of death and disease and suffering and all the rest of it, and you're just going to have to cope with it and look forward to heaven and so on. We might all be a bit dismayed by that. We'd all feel, oh, well, you know, that makes sense. And it wouldn't be this kind of problem of faith in individual lives. The problem of faith so often comes because, you know, the guy next door is healed or helped, and you're not. And why is there the difference? And I think, you know, the only answer to that kind of problem is, well, you just have to trust the Lord, that there's a reason why certain things happen in one way in one person's life and in another way in another person's life. And I think the Bible gives us hints about why sometimes things happen, bad things happen to good people. One is sometimes God is purifying us. I mean, for example, if you're impatient, how does God teach you patience? Except by making you wait for something. Or if you're arrogant and proud, how does God humble you and make you into a person with compassion, unless he puts you through some suffering, so that you then have compassion on other people who suffer? Very often in the healing ministry or in counseling ministries, the people who are most helpful to those who are in need are those who have themselves suffered and learnt through it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. You know, so we know that. But ultimately, there are, you know, questions that we cannot answer. And then the best part of the Bible to turn to really is the book of Job. Because, of course, in the beginning of the book of Job, we are told why Job suffers. Because Satan is basically saying to God, oh, well, the only reason this guy, you know, loves you is because he's got lots of cattle and he's wealthy and he's got, you know, a nice wife and all the rest of it. If I take away all these things, he'll hate you. And so God allows Satan to do that, to show that actually Job is a good man and really does love him. And so that's another reason why our faith is tested. You know, what do we really love God for his own sake, only because of the things he gives us?
So who's ordaining the evil in the
place? Well, in the book of Job, it's in that particular instance, not in all instances, but in that particular instance, you know, as Revelation reveals it, that was Satan. Satan certainly is responsible for a lot of illness and disease and cruelty. God could have prevented Satan from, because if you remember, if you read the book of Job, you read God says to Satan, I'll allow you to do this and that, you know, to take away his family or put diseases on him, but I won't allow you to take his life. And then at the end, but the point I'm really getting is at the end of the book of Job, first of all, you have all these Job comforters saying, oh, well, you've obviously sinned in some way. And at the end of the book of Job, you have God's answer, and God says to Job's comforters, you know, you were wrong about saying it was all Job's fault and all the rest of it, and you need to repent and ask him to pray for you. But he says to Job, you know, where were you when I created the universe? He challenges Job, if you like. You could say he pulls rank, but in a way he says, I am omniscient, I am omnipotent, I see everything. I know everything. You only see a tiny part of reality. You only see a tiny part of the picture. So how can you judge my ways and think that you're in the right? And C.S. Lewis argued, he said the great problem about arguing with God is that God is responsible for our very ability to think and argue. And he created us. How could he ever be in the wrong and we in the right? And that's where you have to exercise faith, that God gives you enough reason for trusting in him. He's the creator. He has shown through Christ how much he loves us. He allowed himself to be tortured to death in order to save us. So we can't doubt him as creator. We can't doubt him as redeemer. So we do have reasons for trusting him, but because we're in a fallen world, we do have to trust him in the dark, and that's often very painful. You know, and I can talk to you about, you know, in an intellectual sense about all these things, but whenever I'm going through it, I mean, I find it agony, and I, you know, and my faith is shaken. And that's where you just have, that's where the Christian community is important, you know, brothers and sisters helping each other, loving each other, sharing with each other. We've got, I think you're, you know, we've got about 8 minutes, haven't we, Carol? You need to fill in your forms to say how dreadful this session has been, how you never want to listen to me again. Before you won't be, Carol won't allow you out to get your dinner until you hand in your forms. But yeah, and so, yeah, yeah, Steve. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you see any major, I mean, they must have agreed on that, they must have got a common thinking point. Do you see any major areas where they diverge in terms of the kind of things you'd be talking about?
Not really. Not on, I mean, of course, Tolkien was a Catholic and Lewis was an Anglican. I mean, Lewis, I believe Tolkien sometimes thought some of Lewis's popular works on theology were a bit glib, I think he sometimes thought. I think partly because Tolkien, being a Catholic, I think perhaps thought that, you know, perhaps he thought that laymen, you know, should hesitate to sort of encroach on the sort of territory of, you know, bishops and priests and so on. I mean, I don't know whether he had prejudices like that, but I mean, on the things that Lewis wrote about, I mean, the understanding of God as creator, the understanding of God as redeemer, the kind of themes that pop up in their fiction, they were very similar. I mean, take, for example, the issue of grace. Lewis wrote about grace. Well, you see grace in The Lord of the Rings. You know, at the end, Frodo, you know, he goes to Mount Doom, and then Gollum bites, you know, he claims the ring for his own. He's been kind of taken over by the ring just as he's on the verge, he's supposed to chuck it into the abyss, you know, into the fire. And then Gollum, who sneaks up on him and bites his finger off with a ring and falls into the Mount Doom, you know, with the ring. And that's grace. You know, Frodo has been faithful and brave, but in the end he's about to break. But because he's been faithful and brave, the grace of God rescues him, and, you know, through Gollum. And the reason that there is this grace is because years before, Bilbo had mercy on Gollum and didn't kill him, you know, unnecessarily. And so you have grace there, the theme of grace in The Lord of the Rings. And Lewis used that also in some of his fiction. So I would have thought, and because Lewis, you see, Lewis believed in what he called mere Christianity. He deliberately avoided, as far as he could, writing about issues that divided Christians from each other. So he kept on arguing there's a great body of commonly agreed truth which Christians must defend against the outside unbelieving world. And the disagreements we have among ourselves ought to be, you know, argued out in private. We shouldn't wash our dirty linen in public, sort of thing. And so because Lewis only wrote about sort of publicly, you know, orthodox Christian truths and themes that everyone could agree with, I don't think, you know, one can say there's any difference between his published views and Tolkien's views. But I can't, honestly, Steve, I can't say I'm an expert on that. I wouldn't, you know, but they're very similar. I mean, it is significant. I think really what comes over to me is how similar they were. You know, they both created imaginary worlds of immense power and authenticity. They both have Christian themes in their fiction. Our speaker yesterday evening pointed this out, that Tolkien said that it was only because of Lewis's encouragement that he finished writing The Lord of the Rings and took it to a publisher. So, I mean, they were as close, really, as friends could be, but, you know, no doubt they had arguments about things. I don't think Tolkien was terribly keen on Lewis's wife, you know. There were probably things like personal things, but I'm not an expert on, you know, all the differences between their theologies.
I thought it was funny to talk about how the latency ways, the latency of something to deny the claims to be written, that the Lord of the Rings was an allegory for the evil. He went to somebody say it was just a story, almost as if he wanted to distance himself from it. Right through it, he's just such a rich vein of everything he needs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yes. I mean, a number of books have been written, but I'm not. Steve, you say that I don't know whether. I mean, the point about mustn't misunderstand Tolkien. I mean, obviously, the Lord of the Rings is not a Christian allegory, any more, you know, like Pilgrim's Progress, any more than any of the Narnian books are Christian allegories. But you can write non-allegorical fiction that still has overt Christian themes, and I mean, there's no doubt that I don't think Tolkien denied Christian themes in some of his work. In fact, if you the work of his where you have the most obvious Christian themes, or biblical themes, is his book about the Elder Days, the Silmarillion, about the creation of Middle Earth, where you have a fall taking place. You have a story of the fall, and the story of pride and rebellion among the elves, and so on. So if you like, there's more theology in the Silmarillion than in the Lord of the Rings. But one belief, I mean, a lot of people at the time that the Lord of the Rings came out thought that the ring was influenced by, you know, the atom bomb, you know, a terrible weapon that you can't use, otherwise you'll destroy yourself. And that was nonsense, you know, because the genesis of the Lord of the Rings, you know, goes back to before the first, you know, in the 1920s or something. Yeah. Carol, needs to connect up. I was going to read you extracts from the Narnia books that were relevant to particular themes, but too much, I'm afraid. We never got around to that. But, oh, I think I better switch off. Unfortunately, I got this admission on it. Okay, do you hear that in the control room? Delete this last bit.